Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. One person who put his relationship with God before all else was John Bradburn, murdered because he refused to abandon his beloved leprosy patients. In today's program, we consider the life of someone who liked to describe himself as the vagabond of God. We also reflect on the sad truth that those we might call the voiceless usually have a voice. Their problem is that few people are listening. You worry and fret over so many things, but only one thing is necessary. Surely these words of Jesus in the Gospel for this Sunday are addressed to us today, in our own daily life. Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett now tell us more.
Jesus entered a village where a woman named Martha welcomed him to her home. She had a sister named Mary, who seated herself at the Lord's feet and listened to his words. Martha, who was busy with all the details of hospitality, came to him and said, "Lord, are you not concerned that my sister has left me all alone to do the household tasks? Tell her to help me." The Lord, in reply, said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and upset about many things. One thing only is required. Mary has chosen the better portion, and she shall not be deprived of it."
No mention is made of its name, only a village, but a village which is dear to every Christian because it was dear to Christ. Bethany, or as today's guidebook writes, Al-Azariyeh, an Arabic version of the name of Lazarus, the most famous inhabitant of the village. Today's gospel is not concerned with Lazarus, but with his sisters, Martha and Mary, in a celebrated episode, frequently quoted for the unexpected answer Jesus gives to Martha. It's autumn, probably sometime in October, and the Feast of Tabernacles is imminent. Last week we heard the parable of the Good Samaritan and the account of a traveller's journey down the desert road from Jerusalem to Jericho. Jesus and the disciples are travelling in the opposite direction, up towards Jerusalem. And as we read in other versions of today's Gospel, in the course of their journey he came to a village. The village was Bethany. It is, we read in the guidebook,
a village on the lower eastern slope of the Mount of Olives, nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off, quoting an old version of John, on the Jerusalem-Jericho road. The name Bethany derives from the Greek form of the Hebrew Beth Ananiah, the house of a person named Ananiah, or the shortened version Bethaniah. The site does not seem to have been inhabited prior to the 6th century BC. From that time on, Bethany has been continuously settled and was, as it is now, the last stop on the Jericho road before entering Jerusalem.
When H.V. Morton drove down that road from Jerusalem, he noted that the first sign of life was a well, known as the Fountain of the Apostles. But he mentioned something else.
On my right, a narrow footpath ran back through the hills to Jerusalem. This was the ancient shortcut to Bethany, and the road that Jesus and his disciples would have taken when they went up to the Passover and the Last Supper.
The Jericho road also sends a branch road right up over the crest of the Mount of Olives to Bethphage and Bethany. And on another occasion, our traveller walked this road with, as he writes, the sun beating on it and the heat quivering like white fire on the rocks. Which road did Jesus and the disciples take, I wonder? Did they know the shortcut? Did they already know Martha and Mary? And where did the disciples stay while Jesus was there? It seems they would have had no problem in finding lodgings, for according to the Talmud, Bethany and its neighbour Bethphage were specially noted for their hospitality to pilgrims. On this occasion, when the Feast of Tabernacles was so near, pilgrims would already be converging on Jerusalem, so the two villages would be in readiness for the expected influx. Bethphage seems to have disappeared from the map, for the guidebook tells us that the name now applies to a Franciscan church, built next to the very steep road that descends from the Mount of Olives eastwards towards the village of El Azaria, ancient Bethany, and the Jerusalem-Jericho highway. But we will remember Bethphage for the errand on which Jesus sent two disciples, as Matthew recounts.
When they were near Jerusalem and had come in sight of Bethphage on the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village facing you, and you will immediately find a tethered donkey and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me."
Mark adds that the tethered colt had not yet been ridden by anyone. An invisible reserved was on its back. We are not in Bethphage, however, but in Bethany, and there's an atmosphere of festivity in the village on the little hill. The Feast of Tabernacles was one of the three so-called pilgrim or foot festivals, because pilgrims travel to Jerusalem to celebrate them in the temple. All three have in common the theme of joy in God's presence, writes modern Jewish scholar Norman Solomon.
The festive joy is traditionally expressed in feasting with meat and drink, and with the purchase of new garments for the women. It's a joy which is only complete when allied with concern for the needy. Each of the festivals has a historical, a spiritual, and an agricultural meaning.
So writes Solomon, and in a table explains these: Sukkot, Tabernacles, Autumn. The historical meaning: God protected the Israelites in the desert, and he quotes Leviticus.
"So that your generations should know that I made the Israelites dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt."
The spiritual meaning: God is our protector. This is symbolized as we leave our homes and dwell in simple booths, Sukkot. The agricultural meaning: the final harvest festival of the year. A manual on daily life in Bible times goes into more detail about the festival, known also as the Feast of Booths, because the Israelites lived in tents or arbours during the celebration.
"The festival began on the 15th day of the 7th month, Tishri, and lasted for 7 days. It fell at the end of the harvest season, thus a third name for the festival, the Feast of Ingathering. The priests offered a special burnt offering of 70 bullocks during the week. 2 rams and 14 lambs were the daily burnt offering, and a male goat the daily sin offering. Every 7th year, when there was no harvest because of the sabbatical year, the law of Moses was read publicly during the feast."
We don't know if the women went up to the temple for the feast, but as the manual explains,
"All males were required to appear before the sanctuary of the Lord during Israel's great pilgrim feasts."
And we don't know whether Jesus and the apostles participated in all of the Jewish rituals and feasts. Jesus loved the temple and respected it. He supported it by encouraging his followers to attend it. Yet Jesus said that in this place is one greater than the temple, referring to himself. In John's Gospel, we read that as the Feast of Tabernacles drew near, his relations urged Jesus to leave Galilee and go to Judea, so that his disciples there could see the works he was doing. But Jesus answered them,
"The right time for me has not come yet, but any time is the right time for you. Go up to the festival yourselves. I'm not going to this festival because for me the time is not ripe yet." Having said that, he stayed behind in Galilee.
As we are following Luke's Gospel, we know that Jesus did indeed leave Galilee and go towards Jerusalem. And John goes on,
"However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went up as well, but quite privately, without drawing attention to himself. At the festival, the Jews were on the lookout for him. 'Where is he?' they said. When the festival was half over, Jesus went to the temple and began to teach."
So it sounds as if the journey to Jerusalem Jesus made was with the apostles and close disciples, but that he preferred to let his relations go on ahead, to avoid the clamour they seem so often to have roused with their criticisms of his behaviour. And so here he is, sitting quietly in Bethany, having left his companions to go over to Jerusalem, a couple of miles away, to fulfil their temple duties. Perhaps Lazarus is with them. His sisters, however, are at home. And as Norman Solomon comments, festival celebrations are as much a matter for the home as for the synagogue. Solomon is writing today, when the temple is no more, and the synagogue is the centre of Jewish worship. Let's hear how H.V. Morton imagines the scene at Bethany that day so long ago.
Sitting on the little hill above Bethany, I could visualise the scene. The house with the smell of cooking around it for the Feast of Tabernacles, at which this incident occurred, was a busy time for Jewish women, and the little arbour of green leaves, the tabernacle of the feast, beneath which Jesus would be sitting in the courtyard with Mary at his feet. They would both be able to see and hear Martha, busy with her pots and pans, and she would see Jesus and Mary so cool and idle while she was so busy. How well her irritation is conveyed by the fact that she includes Jesus in her rebuke. "Lord, do you not care that my sister is leaving me to do all the serving by myself? Please tell her to help me." She might have said, "Lord, see how my sister is leaving me to serve alone." But she is too angry. If they'd been invisible from her kitchen, she might not have been so angry. She would not have seen her sister so cool and tidy, so calm and so intelligent. But Jesus and Mary were sitting in the courtyard, in a leafy summer house of fresh boughs, the peace that surrounded them and the shade in which they sat, throwing into relief her own labours, quickening her self-pity and her sense of injustice. As Martha stands before Jesus, we know her so well. She is immortal and international. In every language under the sun and in every age, Martha has broken into a discussion with an indignant, "You sit there doing nothing while I'm working my fingers to the bone." And the reply she receives from the arbour is enough to bring tears to her eyes. "Martha," says Jesus, mentioning her name twice, and thus putting great affection into what followed. "Martha, Martha, you worry and fret about so many things, and yet few are needed, indeed only one. It is Mary who has chosen the better part. It's not to be taken from her."
Luke's account ends here, a mere 100 words, but so dense with meaning that no more words are needed. Silence is the only possible sequel. And silence is what one imagines followed those words of our Lord. What did Martha do? Standing at the kitchen door, holding one of those pots or pans, she puts it down and throws herself at the feet of the Master. Behind her, a bubbling or sizzling warns her that she must go and see that nothing is burning. But she takes no notice. If it burns, what does it matter? Nothing matters but to be with him. Much has been written on the different advantages of the active and the contemplative life, wrote St. Ambrose.
"The one life is in the arena, the other in a cave. The one is opposed to the confusion of the world, the other to the desires of the flesh. The one subdues, the other flees the pleasures of the body. The one more agreeable, the other safer."
He was a soul in search of his God, a prolific poet and a wanderer, until he found his home in Zimbabwe, amongst the people with leprosy. We now reflect on the life of John Bradburn.
He's a hippie saint. It's true. He has a long hair and he's got this red band around his head to keep the hair together.
I'd never heard of John Bradburn before I went to Zambia. Yet, during my 12 years there, his name was mentioned repeatedly and always with a tremendous degree of respect. People seemed to take it for granted that he is a saint, even though Father Leo McCarthy, a Franciscan friar, has only just been given the responsibility of officially collecting information about God's vagabond, as Bradburn liked to describe himself. Yet, however unlikely a St. John Bradburn might be according to his physical appearance, he might be just what Zimbabwe needs at this present moment.
The country moves on and we just hope for better days, you know. But it's going to be a journey too. I think that a man like John Bradburn, he offers people hope, because the heart of renewal of Zimbabwe will only come through love. It'll only come through care for the poor, care for the needy. It will not come through any other means except a deep spirit of forgiveness and a real care for those who are in need. And that's what John Bradburn would say to us today.
Archbishop Pius Ngqube of Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, added his own comment.
John Bradburn was a great man. And I heard, for instance, of a woman. She was a woman, tremendous faith, an African woman. Young, I think she was late 20s. The doctors had told her there was no way to help her. She had cancer, the uterus or something like that. And she realized, well, the doctors are not going to help me. And she went over and she was praying there, I think, for a whole week at John Bradburn's. And coming from there, one day, I think, after Mass, after receiving communion, she felt herself well again. She went to the doctors. She had been healed.
But who was John Bradburn?
So John Bradburn was born in England in 1921. He had two brothers and two sisters. His father was an Anglican parson. But he was always a man who we might call the pilgrim soul, searching, maybe a dreamer you might call it, but in the real sense of one searching for a meaning to life, above all for a deep spiritual meaning. So eventually he studied at the university, and then he had to go into the army. The war was on, and he was posted out to Malaya. And there he met John Dove. I mentioned him already, the Jesuit, who became a Jesuit later, became great friends. And during that time in the army in the Far East, he was known very much for his love for prayer, his love for stillness and quietness, and a wonderful devotion to, as he called her, Miriam, as our Blessed Lady. Anyway, to make a long story maybe short, he actually came back then to England after the war, and he continued this search. In fact, he wrote a lovely poem called A Strange Vagabond for God. A vagabond, a one who is searching and travelling for God. And he still yearned for this deep spiritual life. In order to pursue that then, he tried his hand at various orders and congregations. But in the meantime, he became a Catholic, and he then began to join various orders and so on. And most of them said that in letters they wrote, he's very good, but this doesn't seem to be the kind of life that would suit this young man. So eventually, as part of his journey, he went to the Holy Land, travelling on a ship and then walking and walking throughout the Holy Land and praying at the various shrines and so on. And then he later then, back in Italy, he joined the Third Order of St. Francis.
And why the Franciscans?
So in a sense, here we find the putting together of a very special charism he had, and that is his deep love for St. Francis. He was always inspired by Francis of Assisi with the love for the lepers, Francis of Assisi, the lover of nature, Francis of Assisi, the poet, because in fact John Bradburn would write 6,000 lines of poetry during his life. He was a poet, he was a poet, he was a dreamer and a poet, he was a searcher. And he wrote to Father John Dove, his great friend, who at this time was now in what we call at that time Southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and he said, is there a cave in Africa? A cave. So John said, well, there are many, many caves in Africa. I just want a cave, he said. I want to grow in the life of prayer and the spirit. And I mentioned earlier his great love for Our Lady Miriam, but he had a tremendous love for the Blessed Trinity. This was very central to his spiritual life, the Trinity, the life of God. Anyway, Father John Dove, of course, went along to the Franciscans, who had gone to southern Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, in 1958. And he said, "Brothers, there's a young man from England who would like to come out and live on the mission as a man of prayer. Have you a place for a man like that?" So Father Boniface said, "Why not? Anyone that comes to pray with us is more than welcome. It'll certainly be a help to us." So he came out to Africa, to Zimbabwe, and he joined the Franciscan friars down in a place called Gandichibuva. Oh, it's really the bushland. Back in the bush, we might say. And there he lived in the friary. And yes, he was very prayerful there. And in fact, Father Pascal Sleven, who is now back in Ireland, retired missioner, knew him very well. He lived in the house with him. And in fact, John Bradburn wrote a lovely poem about Father Pascal. He said, "Here is a true Franciscan," he said. He loved his way, his style. So he spent quite a while there at Gandichibuva. And then, still searching, he wasn't happy yet, you know. He'd got to the missions, he'd got to Africa, but he hadn't found this cave. So he said to the friars, "There's a place up on the hill," he said, "and it's a water tank with a little room below the water tank. What about that? Could I just live there?" I said, "Well, as long as you come down once a week to see us. And I'll do my own cooking," he said. "I want to eat the food of the people." That meant sadza, in Imoriwo, sadza and vegetables. So he spent, yes, he said, I've seen that place today. It's wonderful to visit it. So small. Yet he lived there and he prayed there. He was a man of God. Later then he went to Silveira House, the Jesuit house. And he was still searching. But the great turning point came. I'm going to move on now because there's lots of little things, stories about the bees and story about his various ways of travelling around, you know, and being sent with the car to get fuel and putting diesel in instead of petrol and all that little stories, you know. Anyway, he went one day in 1969 to a place called Mutemwa. There was this lady going up to visit the lepers there. So she said to John, "Would you like to come with me for the drive?" Which he said he would. So he went to Mutemwa. Now Mutemwa is near Mutoko, which is on the road towards Mozambique. And there he came to the leper settlement. He met the lepers. And then he said to Heather, who was had accompanied him, "I am staying here," he said. "I have found my place at last. All my wandering is over. I have found the place at last. It's among the lepers." So she said, "Well, you're coming back with me, whatever you're doing. I'm not going back and tell the Jesuits that I left you up there. So you come back with me, okay?" "Okay," he said, "but I am coming back here." So he went back and he packed his little belongings, told the Jesuits he was heading to Mutemwa, and there he went and there he lived for 10 years.
Reaching out to the marginalised and the excluded is often as simple and as difficult as letting their voices be heard. Father Joe Rozanski says more.
Look at our gospel living, you know, a lot of times some of the problems that we faced in the church are when people either overemphasize the future or overemphasize the present. And it seems to me that the eschatology, the idea of a theology that takes into account the future that we're striving for, is absolutely essential because, first of all, it gives us hope. But second of all, it allows us to look for ways of doing things that do bring in this idea of a new times, a new signs, new ways of doing things.
Those who are marginalized in society often find themselves longing for new times and a world where their voices will be heard. Father Joe Rozanski, who coordinates the activities of the Order of Friars Minor in Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation, points out that we have a responsibility to let voices be heard that are otherwise submerged by a materialistic world.
It's not that we shouldn't be concerned about issues at the top. We should be. But at the same time, we have to take into account the people at the bottom, and there needs to be a real respect for them. You know, for example, one of the things that we've talked about a lot is being the voice for the voiceless. And we have basically been asked by some of our people not to say that, because it's not that they don't have voices, but it's the fact that they've been put in a part of society where they're not heard very much.
Which is where the advocacy is so important.
Yes. So we need to find ways. We need to learn how to walk with people who have their own voices, but at times they need to find contacts. They may need to find ways to get their message out.
Once you start showing solidarity and advocacy for those who are the excluded, it's the excluded themselves who can then build up within the community of the excluded.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think, yes, very much so. And again, that's the whole idea that we mentioned earlier about it's not that people don't have voices. It's just that, you know, a lot of times our social structures don't allow people the kind of pulpit that other people have to be able to talk about what's going on. But I think that if people receive good education, receive training, and receive also this kind of extended hand that you're talking about, whether from Jesus, from Francis, or from us, you know, we begin to create the foundations for a different kind of world. I think it doesn't always work. It's not always the most positive thing, and sometimes this is a very difficult kind of task. I imagine that there would have been lepers around who, if Francis tried to embrace them, they would have ran away, thinking that the guy was crazy or something. But it shows us about the need to have also perseverance in our work. You know, sometimes the first two steps are really very enthusiastic, and then it's the plodding through the rest of life that's difficult. When you look and see Francis, you know, there were the high points that were really great, but there was also a lot of heartache and difficulties that Francis faced as well as he tried to make these virtues, as he tried to incarnate the virtues that you're talking about here. And I think it's the same for us, too. We need to do our best, but we also need to realize that we're instruments. You know, God invites us to do the work, but, you know, getting back to the whole theme of spirituality again, when we talk about life in the Spirit, we're breathed upon by God and by the Spirit and invited to be, you know, the hands and the feet of God in our world today.
So we come to the end of our program for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.